3,009 miles distance of the Earth to the Moon. Phobos is so close that it transits the Sun pretty much every day in some location of Mars, making this something of a less than rare event. But still, that doesn't take away from how cool it really looks to see an eclipse from another world through the eyes of an intrepid rover. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS. Okay, Doc. Well, I've offered you a link to the rover's view of the Martian solar eclipses. What about the sounds of the rovers roving about the surface of Mars? Before meeting its end in a planet-circling dust storm, the Opportunity rover traversed nearly 30 miles over the perilous Martian surface. In some ways, many people traveled along with Opportunity, thanks to the thousands of images it sent back to Earth. But what did Opportunity's journey sound like? Unfortunately, there weren't any microphones transmitting sounds heard by Opportunity or its partner Spirit, but surely there must have been some noises going on through the thin atmosphere as the rovers kicked up the ruckus of their wheels of ground over rocks and dry dust. Luckily, curious among us, NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, California, has a rover test bed, including a large area designed to recreate Mars' surface called Mars Yard. There, engineering models of rovers traverse the model terrain. Together with the science of sound, we can figure out what the rovers sounded like, both on the Earth and on Mars. Opportunity's cleated metal wheels, each with their own motor rolling 2 inches per second over Martian rock, created the exact crackling sound you'd expect from a metal-wheeled robot rolling over dirt. Meanwhile, the larger Curiosity rover presents an utter cacophony of screeches as its own metal wheels traverse the rocks of the Mars Yard. Let me drop for a second.
Once again, Roy, how fast do those wheels rotate?
They say 2 inches per second.
Okay, 2 inches per second. Awesome. I was hearing 2 revolutions per second. What was I wrong?
It's not a speed buggy. Anyway, there's a big difference in the way sound travels through the air on Mars compared to Earth, as we should know. Sound is just our brains translating vibrations in air molecules into more meaningful data. But how the sound travels is dependent on the air it travels through. Mars's atmosphere is mostly composed of carbon dioxide and is about 1% the thickness of Earth's atmosphere, which is made out of 78% nitrogen, 21% oxygen, and a trace amount of other good stuff like argon and carbon dioxide. The difference in the component's molecule structure and the thickness of our air would produce 2 noticeable distortions to sounds once you're a few feet away from the rover. There aren't enough molecules to carry the high-frequency sounds, the ones with the shortest wavelength. So, at farther distances, you wouldn't hear sounds with frequencies above 10,000 hertz. Not that many people our age can hear frequencies above 10,000 hertz. Anyway, the pitch that gives cymbals and bells their brilliant quality. On the other end, the lower bass notes with frequencies around 100 hertz disappear on Mars, as some energy would otherwise cause the waves to move forward instead are spent making the carbon dioxide molecules just rotate a little bit faster. Additionally, you're not just standing on the Mars in shorts and t-shirts. You're bearing the winds and low pressure atmosphere and cold temperature in a spacesuit. The sounds would be a lot more muffled. Let me drop for a sec. So, though we'll never hear what Spirit, Opportunity, or Curiosity actually sounded like on Mars, there will soon be some experiments to measure sounds on the red planet. The InSight lander has already measured vibrations from the Martian wind, and the Mars 2020 rover is set to bring 2 microphones aboard so we can finally hear the wind, the rocks, and the grinding metal on Mars' surface. And who knows? Maybe, just maybe, one day, a human will get to hear those sounds directly. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
Very good on the sounds on Mars, but just a piece of information about those wheels. I know I've talked about it before, but some people might not know it. As the wheels go across the surface, there's indentations in all of the wheels, and you know, from the outside of the wheel to the inside, they have NCW, they have JPL, you know, stands for Jet Propulsion Laboratory. So as it rolls along and it crushes the dust and the dirt on Mars, the imprints of JPL winds up on the planet. They actually have a reason for it. They can measure up the distance with their cameras and all. But it's just a good thing to know. If you look at the pictures of the wheels, you'll see it. You know, the close up pictures of any of the rovers. Back to you.
Yeah, I think I remember you telling us that. That's an interesting story. I don't think you could make it out of the sounds of the wheels crunching. Are there any nice images of the Morse code tracks in any of the photos that NASA has done?
Yes, I've seen them. You know, I would imagine you go to Google or Bing and put in, you know, on the images, put in JPL, CW, Mars, rover, you know, wheels. I'm sure some pictures will come up. I've seen them, so I know they're out there. The cameras they usually take with the pictures are underneath the navigation camera. The cameras are the ones that take those kinds of pictures. They'll be in black and white.
Okay, very good. I'll have to take a gander and a look to see if I can find anything like that. I don't recall it, but I my eyes aren't really trained to pick up CW in the ground.
Okay, very good. And you look at the close-up pictures, you know, from the, they have an arm, you know, on the, all these rovers. And it's on the other rovers as well. But the arm, takes the pictures of the wheel from above, and you can actually see it on the wheel itself.
Okay, very good. Thank you very much, Paul. Anyone else with any questions or comments on this? Okay, here's a rather new one for the Science Talk. A pre-announcement to announce an announcement coming this week. The Event Horizon Telescope, a network of telescopes on a mission to observe supermassive black holes at the center of galaxies, is set to release its first results in a public press conference this coming week. They've not offered even a clue of what the results will be, but they have the potential to be utterly worldview-changing. Black holes are objects so compact and dense, they contain a region in their gravitational field, their event horizon, beyond which space is so warped that light itself escapes. We have tons of evidence that black holes exist, from bursts of radiation emitted from the galactic centers to ripples through space-time called gravitational waves, but we've never seen one up close. That's the goal of the Event Horizon Telescope, which operates under a principle called Very Long Baseline Interferometry, or VLBI. The telescope is actually a collaboration of telescopes around the world, from the United States to Chile to the South Pole, which are all observing the same distant object at the same time. The data is brought together at a central location and then decoded and processed to produce a higher resolution image than would be possible with a single telescope. It's like turning the entire Earth into one big telescope. The resolution increase is mind-boggling. Hopefully, the telescope will be able to resolve the center of the galaxy, a region 25,000 light-years away that's only about the size of Mercury's orbit around the Sun. Let me drop for a second. The targets of the telescope's observing run thus far have been Sagittarius A star, a radio wave-emitting region of our galaxy that looks a whole lot like a supermassive black hole with a mass of about 4 million times that of our Sun, as well as the center of galaxy M87, where there is presumably another supermassive black hole, this one being around 7 billion times the mass of our Sun and spewing a high-energy jet of matter. This coming week, the National Science Foundation announced that it and the Event Horizon telescope collaboration would hold a press conference in Washington, D.C., with a simultaneous press conference in Brussels, Santiago, Shanghai, Taipei, and Tokyo to announce a groundbreaking result. Now, again, unfortunately, we don't know what this result will be. We'll probably be talking about this here again after the announcement is actually made. With all this hoopla, it may be incredible, possibly showing the shadow that the black hole creates against the backdrop of the cosmos. It could become one of the most important images in scientific history. Or it could be this decade's Al Capone's vault. But since Geraldo Rivera isn't involved in any of this, we might be safe. Let me drop for a second. So, at this point, we just don't know what it's going to show. It's going to show something different. If it shows something different from the astronomers' expectations, that would be very exciting. But whatever the results, scientists are very excited and waiting with a bunch of questions and potential lines of research that will come out with this data release. So, no doubt, boom or bust, we'll be discussing this here in the weeks to come. The press conference, for anyone interested, will begin on April 10th at 9 a.m. Eastern Daylight Time. Watch this space. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS.
In the case of the release of the information about LIGO making its first detection of two black holes hitting each other, there was a pre-release saying that something good is coming. And they really had something. So in this case, with a similar sounding pre-release, it sounds like they really got something, doesn't it, Roy?
I would assume so. I mean, it's a lot like any other thing. You know, if Apple drums up a big conference, they're not going to show nothing. They're going to show something. So these guys got a good hand, and they'll play it April 10th, apparently, but not a moment before. Other questions or comments? Black holes, this discovery. And keep in mind, of course, that you can't really image a black hole because the whole idea of a black hole is something that soaks up light, and so not even light can escape it. What they'll probably have is some hopefully very nice images of accretion disks being whipped higher and higher in velocity and giving off all manner of radiation before parts of it get swallowed inside the event horizon. But still, should be exciting. Okay, on to the next then. The first interstellar object to visit the solar system defied expectations in 2017, according to a new study, and brought about lots of questions, including whether it was a comet or an asteroid, or some people wanted to believe an alien spaceship. Now, though those studies have determined it was an asteroid, new research finds that the comet hypothesis might still be plausible. Oumuamua first appeared October 19, 2017, in data from the Hawaiian Pan-STARRS telescope. Rather than orbiting the sun, its trajectory clearly implied that it had visited from outside the solar system and then left. Though it didn't stay for long, scientists were able to make 818 observations of the object and found a few strange things. It had elongated shape and a complex rotation, and strangely, it was accelerating as it sped off. More than what would be caused by the effects of the sun's gravity alone. Now, debate has raged as to whether the rock is a comet, an icy body from the outer regions of a star system with a sort of fuzzy atmosphere and a tail, or an asteroid, a rock without a tail that formed closer to its star, or something else entirely different. Now, even though the release of gas from the surface, like a comet, could have explained the anomalous accretion, Oumuamua didn't have an observable tail or an observable carbon gas spewing from its surface. This made scientists wonder if maybe it was something else. Maybe even a flat object like a solar sail accelerating thanks to the push from the sun's particles. Let me drop for a second. But a new paper planned to be published in the Astrophysical Journal puts the brakes on this speculation. It reiterates that a volatile, rich tending structure for Oumuamua provides the simplest explanation for its odd trajectory. In other words, even though we didn't see the gas or the tail, it otherwise looks like it was a comet. This paper simulated an elongated pill or capsule-shaped object emitting a nozzle-like jet of vaporized particles, mostly water vapor, which might explain why we didn't see any tail. The model produced results that looked much like those observed in Oumuamua, including the tumbling behavior and the extra acceleration. Unsurprisingly, initial opponents of the hypothesis weren't convinced by the new results. Harvard fan of the dubious little green men solution, Avi Loeb, said that a new finding was based on assumptions that the extrasolar objects act like solar system objects, while the University of Cambridge, Roman Rufikov, said the paper required the comet to be in ideal shape. So, not so much has changed. The astronomers still disagree about the nature of Oumuamua. Hopefully, more interstellar objects will visit the solar system soon and provide us with more to study and debate over. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS.
1YDY?
Yes, Hank.
Did they ever determine how Oumuamua, if I'm pronouncing it correctly, appeared to accelerate?
Definitively, no. Their theory is that there were substances, and as it approached closer to the sun, they became volatile and were given off as gases and produced additional non-gravitational forces that caused the acceleration.
Okay.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Okay, Hank, it timed out just as you were about to say something. So what was it that you...
I'm going to say that makes sense. It was an impulse acceleration based on a volatile gas that occurred after the object warmed in proximity to the sun, probably perihelion.
I would agree, Hank. I sort of believe in Occam's razor that the most likely answer is usually the right answer. And this strange guy from Harvard who's really into little green men, that it was a solar sail from an alien probe, I think it's been watching too many Star Trek episodes personally.
No, I wasn't trying to suggest that.
I didn't think you would. I wonder at Harvard and if they're rethinking their professorship. Okay, anyone else with any questions or comments about the mysterious Oumuamua?
WS2S.
Yes, Paul.
Yeah, I know I've commented to you about this before, about the book that was written many years ago in the early 70s called Rendezvous with Rama, written by Arthur C. Clarke. So if anybody likes to read science fiction, that book is amazingly similar to what this, I think they're calling it a comet, some people are calling it an asteroid now, but when it visited the sun and it accelerated away, that's exactly what happens in the book. And the book is a long structure similar to this one. Although the book is more of a cylinder with 30 miles wide and 30 miles long with 6 miles in diameter. I think six kilometers, I think, in diameter. But it's a good book. I recommend it, and it's fascinating because this object was similar to it. The people that discovered it, of course, a lot of those people read science fiction books, were thinking about naming the object Rama after the book. Back to you, Roy. WS2S.
May I, in 1YDY?
Yes, Hank.
Paul, actually, it made me go reread the trilogy. The first one's great. Don't bother with the next two.
I concur.
Unfortunately, I think that's a trend with Arthur C. Clarke. He has great ideas, but he needed to support, living in Sri Lanka and such. And so he would extend things beyond their lifetime. He was not a great guy for trilogies and such.
WS1.
Yes, Paul.
He had brought another guy in to co-write the book with him, the second book. came out of JPL, so he had help, but I think maybe that's where it gets bogged down.
Possibly, but I remember 2010, which was the next book after 2001. And although originally 2001 was based on a short story and then turned into a book, unfortunately, Arthur C. Clarke was a great writer, but I think he kind of really needed those checks.
Didn't like 2010. Don't bother with 2061 or 3001.
I mean, the whole series was kind of muddled. If not for Stanley Kubrick, I don't think people would care one way or the other. But it only goes to show that a great director and a good amount of budget and a couple of great ideas can turn into a masterpiece.
Well, in one way, you might get me. Sentinel, the short story from which 2001 was extrapolated, was never meant to be very long.
I realize it. It was a stretch, and it was just a happenstance that Stanley Kubrick was able to kind of twist and turn the story into something that's become a classic. Now, personally, and it'll upset the movie guys, but it's not Gone with the Wind. It's not Kane Mutiny. It's but it was a good book. It was a good movie. I enjoyed the movie. I enjoyed the science in the movie, and I enjoy Arthur C. Clarke's usual short stories and books where people weren't really pressuring him to write the damn thing, and it was just thought of his own mind. Usually when guys follow paychecks, it doesn't end well.
Have to agree. Those early books were one whitey white.
Bravo Zulu with a question.
Yes, Rich.
How far did Stanley Kubrick deviate from the original?
The Sentinel was just a short story. It probably wouldn't have lasted a movie that took more than about 15, 20 minutes. So he punched it up. I don't really remember the differences between The Sentinel and 2001, the book, and 2001, the movie. Hank remembers how they differed.
Every line and the arc of the story basically was the same.
May I and one whitey white?
Please.
Okay, negative on the arc of the story from The Sentinel to the movie or the book. The movie and the book were written 80% or so prior to the start of the filming, and the last 20% Stanley Kubrick actually made or locked Arthur C. Clarke out of what he was doing, and he did so deliberately so that Arthur C. Clarke would write a different novel to the movie Stanley was making. And the big difference is that the spaceship Discovery went to Jupiter in the movie and it went to Saturn in the book. The rings of Saturn were discovered to be the detritus of a moon that was flattened in order to create a spot for another of the monoliths. But, you know, it was similar in concept, but different in details.
Did Kubrick add to the science or detract from it?
I believe that they were about the same. The only difference that I, or a real issue that I found, was that the size of the centrifuge was wrong. The round section of the spaceship had to have been much, much larger so that you wouldn't have different amounts of gravity affecting your head and your feet while you were running around the centrifuge. But other than that, they said he did pretty well with the science of the movie.
VTGX, huh?
That's a first in Hollywood. Anyway, thanks. Very interesting. W-2 visa.
Yes, Rich, GXM, you want to say something?
Kubrick's beauty in the movie and also its shortcoming was that Kubrick never bothered to explain anything. He took great pains with the science. I mean, notwithstanding the centrifuge size. You know, great things about no sound in space, how you could hold your breath for 7 minutes in a vacuum, and all the various other bits. But he didn't explain anything that the book explains, which I found very fascinating. I found that the book explained a lot. When I was thinking about the movie, I was thinking, oh, that's what happened to WB2GXM.
Different forms, and what you're talking about is exposition, and in Hollywood, exposition is the death of any film. So he couldn't take time to stop, and it, maybe through the dialogue of the drama that was going on, you know, he could have interjected that, but probably it would have been way too hard to do it to an accountant's specifications, which is are the people who run Hollywood. W2BZ.
And WS2M.
Yes, Paul.
With 2001 Space Odyssey, that book came out after the movie. He felt he needed to decode that movie. Otherwise, you wouldn't even have that book. So, that's what happened there. And then I got to the end of the book. I still couldn't figure it out, but it was a good movie.
Yeah, Paul, you know, part of it was to answer the question, what the heck did I just see? And the other was for that paycheck, so he could keep that nice little, place that he had in Sri Lanka. But, I mean, that was the problem that I had, I think, initially with the movie. At first, I didn't have a clue of what the ending meant at all. Not the faintest idea. I mean, I was probably about 12 years old at the time or something, so, you know, but I didn't have a clue.
YDY. I was a little younger, but I got to tell you, I did not have a clue what that third child was either. Somebody had to explain that to me.
I mean, I thought that everyone LSD or something. I don't know. It looked really trippy as opposed to anything that made sense to me.
Days.
Yes, Rich?
I have a father that understood a little bit about science and understood a little bit about how movies are made. And so I got the explanation that was pretty darn close to what people have said 30 years later was right.
You were more fortunate than I. I had to wait for the book to come out and figure it out. And as you mentioned, you know, the book didn't make a whole lot of sense, but it made more sense than Stanley Kubrick's work. But he was an auteur, so you expect mystery in auteurs. Rich, I believe you wanted to make some comment also?
When you said it was trippy, all I said was those were the days of trippiness.
Yeah, it was very in the time, so that was what my young brain just kind of went to, except that I didn't know where the LSD was coming from.
Faster in space.
Now, in the words of Avi Loeb, probably green men put it there.
A famous guy named Owsley. Maybe someday on the science talk, Roy, you could go into the chemistry and the science behind hallucinogenics. Everything's about, you know, these days about opioids, but hallucinogenics were much more interesting, and I would love to hear what the science is behind them.
Okay. How the brain works is an incredibly complex and intriguing subject, so maybe I'll dig up something appropriate and do a bit on it.
Yeah. Great. Just announce it beforehand, I guess, so we could all listen in. No, but you don't do that. You don't do that. You surprise us every week. Yeah, but if you could, Roy, I'd be an eager listener. Whiskey 2, Bravo Zoo.
I'll put you down. The other Rich, GXM, wanted to say something?
It is true that science fiction predicts a lot of things that eventually do come true, whether circular or not. I see that 2001 predicted the camcorder, but it was pointed out to me later that it also predicted the tablet, which is fascinating. WPTGXM.
Okay, but a whole different, a whole bunch of people have kind of predicted the tablet. It kind of is intuitive. It's very similar to a notepad that's electronic, so it's not a big jump. Sometimes these guys are incredibly clever. Sometimes it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. People point to the StarTAC cell phone, the one of the earlier flip phones is looking like a Star Trek communicator. But my guess is that back in the 60s, the guy who designed the StarTAC and flip phones in general were watching Star Trek, either in high school or college or someplace, and so the concept got imprinted in them. There are also Star Trek Next Generation that has things that look like tablets. There is Star Trek that has plastic little rectangles that people say look like floppies. So, sometimes people look at hieroglyphics and they think they see helicopters as well. So there's all kinds of mind play at work.
Bravo Zulu.
Stretch.
Turn it over to me. Roy.
Stretch. It's turned over to you.
That's when we communicated over the week that you said you might look into is that woman who tried to pull off almost $1 billion scheme with her mini blood machine called the Edison, and why ultimately it turned out to be a fraud. The science behind that would be fascinating, too.
I'll look into it. I've read even more about it. Unfortunately, it's mostly science fiction. There's really nothing underlying the concept that's doable in this part of the 20th century, and that was one of their problems. In the end, they were simply using other people's standard technology to do the lab experiment and the lab test. And their entire concept, something made up by a very aggressive young woman who had dropped out of college and decided to be a billionaire. So that's her scientific background, unfortunately. But I'll look into it further.
What you're saying was her original scientific assumption was no way workable, no matter how much money you threw at it. And we're talking about, there's a documentary on HBO about this woman who raised $900 million to come up with a little machine that can very quickly analyze blood. Over to you, Roy. Go ahead.
It was very much a kind of tale that underlines most of the strangeness going on in Silicon Valley. She went to the same investment group people. She pulled the same scams that many people before and probably after her tried. And she did those little talks that people do, put them on YouTube, put them all over the place, made a big name for herself. And it was all pretty much a con. Maybe in the 50 years, the technology will develop that will allow you to do that. But, you know, it's sort of like one of those great ideas that have no technological basis whatsoever. It would be nice if there was a time machine. Well, yes, it would be nice. But you build one. I don't know. Well, neither did she. It was a big fraud case, and she'll probably spend a couple of decades in a prison someplace. Unless someone with a lot of money somehow gets her better lawyers, and then she'll only spend a few years.
Unless she knew from the beginning it was a fraud. I don't think she did. But anyway, I guess a lot of people don't know what we're talking about, so I'll shut up. Whiskey 2, Baker Zanzibar.
Very good, Rich. I don't know how much she convinced herself and how she was just doing a grift. That's up to the legal system to probably figure out. But let me drop for a second, and then I'll move on to a completely different story. Just when you thought those inscrutable Chinese would take a pause with their genetic engineering and their cloning, comes this lovely story. Now, earlier this month, a Southwestern Police Department in China received its newest canine trainee. And normally that wouldn't earn a mention here, except that this pup was China's first clone police dog, according to Chinese state media. The two-month-old pup is called Kunyun and is a Kunming wolf dog, cloned from a seven-year-old veteran police dog. Kunyun was cloned via somatic skin sample on September 12th of last year, which was taken back to Peking, where an embryo was then implanted in a surrogate beagle. The program itself was set up by the China's Ministry of Public Security and led by the Kunming Police Dog Base, Yunnan Agricultural University, and Peking Synergene Biotechnology Company Limited. Synergene is no stranger to the dog cloning business. It's actually the first biotech company in China to provide pet cloning services. Just last year, it also cloned a popular celebrity pup named Juice and charges about 380,000 yuan, or about $55,000, to clone pets. Let me drop for a second. While this dog isn't the first clone dog, it's somewhat troubling to hear that the main reason was to cut down on the time and cost involved in training police dogs. According to the China Daily, which is an English-language newspaper by the Chinese Communist Party, police dog training in China takes somewhere between 4 and 5 years, to the tune of about a half a million yuan. Cloning police dogs is an experimental phase, they said. It's hoped that we can mass-produce cloned, good-performing police dogs as techniques mature in the next 10 years. A researcher at Kunming Police Dog Base told China Daily. The program also plans to establish a somatic cell bank of good-performing police dogs that can be preserved for 50 years and a group of good-performing police dogs for breeding to fast-breed good police dogs, end quote. There's little reason to believe that a dog's clone will behave exactly like its parents, even if they share the same genetics. Clones do not, for the record, retain memories of their predecessors. Singer Barbara Streisand famously cloned her dog Samantha, only to find the resulting puppies had different personalities. In a New York Times op-ed, Streisand penned, she said you can clone the look of a dog, but you can't clone the soul. Still, it's possible that the dog could turn out to be more receptive to training than others. Let me drop for a second. Another potential issue with the idea of cloning genetically superior animals for industrial or service reasons is it's not exactly clear if cloned animals suffer from accelerated aging. Dolly, you remember Dolly, the first ever cloned sheep, died at 6 years of age, which according to the Smithsonian is half the average age of a regular sheep. But later scientists found that her cloning origins didn't contribute to her premature death. Meanwhile, the first cloned dog, Snuffy, lived for 10 years, but eventually died from the same cancer that killed its cloned parents. There is currently a study monitoring Snoopy's cloned offspring to monitor the health and lifespan of cloned animals. For the new police dog, she's just entering training, and supposedly, if you believe the media, has a good aptitude on tests for sniffing, detecting, and adapting to unfamiliar environments. If the Chinese find this the easiest way to breed more useful dogs, maybe one day they'll consider doing the same thing for more useful citizens. I don't know about you, but in Aldous Huxley's Brave New World, this really didn't end so well. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2. Yes. Okay, so much for cloning. Anyway, tired of scary airplane news? Well, so am I. So let's try a goofy airplane story this time where no one... Once you're on an airplane, your fate is in the hands of your pilot. You're going where they want you to go. Now, unfortunately, the pilot of a recent British Airways flight from London to Dusseldorf, Germany, somehow ended in Scotland, 525 miles away from the whole plane full of people's intended destination, all thanks to some very shoddy paperwork. The BBC reported that passengers only realized the error when the clueless pilot announced to their confused passengers, "Welcome to Edinburgh." The passengers thought it was a joke until the airline stewardess asked by a show of hands who was expecting to go to Dusseldorf that day. Reportedly, every passenger raised their hand. The pilot said he had no idea how it happened. He said it never happened before and that the crew was trying to work out what they could do, a passenger told BBC. Let me drop for a second. The flight plan was filed by WDL Aviation. The company is working with British Airways to find out what happened, the BBC reports. It appears a flight plan from the day before may have made its way onto the schedule for the following day. British Airways contacting the customers that made the involuntary stopover to Edinburgh, though. British Airways declined to comment on how many travelers were affected by the mistake. You know, shades of wrong Lake Corrigan. For you history buffs, Douglas Corrigan took off just a small distance from me at Floyd Bennett Field in 1938 with a flight plan listed and planned to be Long Beach, California. Then he landed in Dublin, Ireland. You would have thought that the Atlantic Ocean underneath him would have been a dead giveaway if something was amiss. Anyway, let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS.
Okay, this is N1YDY with two comments, if I may.
Certainly may, Hank.
First, as far as Wrong Lake Corrigan is concerned, went where he intended to go. He simply was dealing with a federal government that was not giving him permission to go where he wanted to go in the aircraft that he had. So, you know, it's a story that he came up with so that he wouldn't face prosecution, but not what he was trying to do, not where he was intended. Fortunately, the pilot of the aircraft that landed in Scotland is not the guy who made the mistake. Work told him he went, he did the airplane, he told the airplane where he wanted to go, they did all the right thing, got there. What this really is, a cautionary tale for outsourcing. British Airways, trying to reduce its costs, buying dispatch services from a third-party vendor who doesn't pay their workforce what British Airways would have to pay to have those services. Really dealing with simply outsourcing.
I agree with you entirely, Hank. The Wrong Way Corrigan I just thought was a funny story, and he did actually leave from Floyd Bennett Field, which is very close to me here. And as a matter of fact, I was able to see the old New York Post headline. It said, Hail Wrong Way Corrigan, but it was spelled backwards. And it was all just a big joke, because obviously he noticed that when he was... He knew exactly where he was going, because if you were traveling from New York to California, you're not going past an ocean. So obviously he knew exactly what was going on. And as mentioned before, it was the flight plan that got screwed up in the story. But I thought it was a humorous story, and like I said before, no one actually died.
I guess I should let it go, but, you know, it's just one of those things when you deal with airlines that are trying to, all companies that are trying to save money, and they outsource certain functions that need to be before accountability. It's just one of the things that presses my buttons, actually more so than the whole Boeing thing. I understand the Boeing thing much readily than I understand what happened with BOAC.
I understand, Hank. I wish people took a little bit more pride in work and did things for themselves instead of looking at the lowest priced contractor out there and settling for something less than a decent day's work. Rich, I think, wanted to say something.
I want to ask, Hank. It's my understanding that commercial flights landing at wrong airports, which sounds like, you know, one in a billion or whatever it is, are much more common than you would think. Is that true?
Yeah, it's common. In fact, back in the late 80s, Delta had a string of six of them within a 13 or 14, a little more than a year, but less than a year and a half period. Got to the point where industry insiders used to joke that Delta stood for don't ever land there again.
You think, back then, you know, with so much less automation than there is now, but now they punch it all into a computer. and it still happens, which boggles the mind.
Well, I suggest to you that it's much more likely punching it into a computer than it ever was when you had three heads or three brains in a cockpit, and they were all doing the work manually, or at least mentally. Three people that are fully involved are likely to figure out what's going on a lot sooner than one person or two people that are half asleep or complacent because they put it in the magic box and they have a tremendous amount of faith in the results. I used to notice at one point in time, the company that I worked for required that we do our weight and balances manually. Let me drop. And I found that both with myself and with the co-pilots that I had, the young men that were capable of adding and dividing in their heads were much less likely to make an error. Let me rephrase that. They weren't less likely to make the error, but they were much more likely to catch the error, and they were much less likely to hand the paperwork in with an error than the guy who simply used the calculator to do it, because the kids that did it in their head had an automatic reasonableness test that was going on subconsciously, and when they got an answer that didn't make sense, they went back and found it, whereas the people that use automation tend to accept the results.
Is there a common mistake that, you know, what's the nature of the mistake?
Well, today the nature of the mistake is that, you know, it's all keystroke entries into little boxes that are on either side of the center console in an aircraft, and they're called McDo's, and I'm trying to remember what McDo stands for at the moment. It's escaping me, but it's essentially a screen with a keypad, and of course it's intended to be industrial, so it's not touchscreen. They're expecting you to actually hit the buttons, and the buttons are heavy duty, but you know, it's essentially a interactive screen, and if you make an error, if you look at something and you type it incorrectly, and you fail to recognize that before you hit the send button or the enter button, you can have fuel miscalculations, you can have thrust miscalculations, you can have waypoint miscalculations, because all these things go through the same input device, the same McDo.
They typing in the wrong name of the city they're supposed to go to?
Well, they type in the wrong three-letter identifier. You know, LGA, everybody can figure out. LAX, everybody can figure out. But there are a lot of places in the country that have identifiers that make no sense. Sometimes they're, an alphanumeric, such as N57. You try to keep that straight in your head for all the different airports that are around. So that's one of the reasons you still have paperwork when you are putting these things in, so that you don't make these mistakes. But my experience, that the people that had the greatest amount of experience with the old paper charts made fewer mistakes than the people that were simply punching in numbers and letters.
Common denominator is punching in the airport identifier.
Oh, I tried to say that's not the common denominator. The common denominator is any keystroke error. It doesn't matter whether you're talking about the destination aircraft or airport, or the fuel load, or the assumed temperature for takeoff thrust settings. Any of these things, single keystroke error, can create a problem. It has a varying degree of severity depending upon whether it's simply slightly less or slightly more thrust on takeoff or your balance of field length, or whether you're pointed in the wrong direction, or like those gentlemen that went from, were supposed to land in Detroit and flew right on by it by about 60 miles and turned around and had to head back. So, I mean, there's all sorts of methods by which you can make an error.
How does a weight and balance error translate into landing at the wrong airport? Is it that they get a warning in the cockpit and that they better land at an alternative airport no matter how far, how far past where they are or not up to where they were going? Is that what it is? It says you better land because they're out of fuel. I don't understand it. If you make an error inputting and you go into LGA or KLGA and you put KLGB, that could send you to anywhere in the country or the world, I guess. No, the country because of the K.
Well, sort of. Mentioned weight and balance in different airports. Input for your flight plan. Input for your fuel load. The input for your weight and balance is all done with the same device. So I'm not suggesting that you make a weight and balance error and it sends you to the airport. And you might not have the performance that you expect if you make a weight and balance error. The aircraft is heavier than it is. It'll fly better than you thought it will. Under most circumstances, with the exception of being performance on the actual takeoff runway. That's just one particular error. If you think lighter than it is, it will not perform as well as you expect.
They think they're in an emergency condition usually. That's what results from the error, the input error?
No, not at all. I'm trying to suggest it's, I call it complacency, but perhaps because they don't have basics, pilots don't have the basics. Modern pilots are taught to operate this set of avionics correctly. And we're no longer finding pilots that have operational experience doing things the old-fashioned way. Guys that did it the old-fashioned have this built-in reasonable check because they're looking at things going, does it make sense every time the guys that have grown up operating a computer all their lives, just type in numbers and can't always recognize that the number that they get out isn't the set expected. I think in programming, they used to call it GIGO for garbage in, garbage out.
Has the frequency of landing at the wrong airport, would you say, increased over the years or decreased?
I would certainly think that it decreases, but I know that it happens.
Thank you. Thanks, Roy. Whiskey 2, Bravo Zulu.
And then one Whitey White.
Okay, so thank both of you. It was a good conversation. I'm glad more information got discussed. And as always, it's now the witching hour, 11:06. So I just want to remind everyone again, if you have any mailbag questions, if you have any topics you want me to cover, if you have any comments you want to send me, the address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. And go to the link page. I put up the links for tonight's stories, point.ac2gs.com. And again, want to thank everyone who participated, especially want to thank Hank for his expertise, and thank Dick for this opportunity, and Paul, and so I will hand it over to Dick so Dick can pass it over to Paul, and we'll do this all over again in 2 weeks' time.
Thank you, Roy. Good stuff. And so you'll have a chance to build up a whole bunch of exciting ones in the next 2 weeks. Once again, next week there will be no TechNet. Next up is Paul's of WS2N, and I'm mentioning to Paul that Wednesday issue of Newsday talked about a discussion, a presentation made by Mae Jemison. She's the first black lady astronaut on the space shuttle STS-47. But she gave a talk at Hofstra this week, on Tuesday I think it was, in which she's talking about human space travel to the nearest star. She made it sound like she thinks the greatest impediment there was the interpersonal conflicts that would happen with people in a spaceship for that length of time. But I think I told you I did a calculation that if you get the spaceship up to 50,000 miles an hour at good speed, it'll only take you 13,000 years to get there. So I don't think it's realistic. Imagine a multi-generation spaceship, 13,000 years, that's what the... over 1,000 generations, not likely to be launched, in my opinion. So not quite sure what all is going on here. I wonder if you saw that article, Paul. WS2N, release report number 342. KQI, WNTechNet, you got it, Paul.
this is WS2N, and Mae Jemison. At least she was chosen to be in charge of that group. I believe that was supposed to be 100 years, a program for 100 years from now to be able to go on the way to the stars. So I don't think, I didn't see the article. I know that DARPA had her, they have different things in DARPA. They release money for different types of things. For instance, racing through the desert with autonomous car going from one place to another, and then if you win, you get $1 million, whatever it is. And they had something similar to that, and I think that's where the 100 years come in. They gave her money to set up a society or a group to study the possibility of actually doing that. But I didn't see the report. We'll be looking forward to seeing if they ever get on off the ground 100 years from now. I'll be there.
Yeah, you have to realize, you have to ask yourself, what's the goal of a project like that? And you're sending human beings out there at a tremendous distance. They're going to take a look-see. Are they going to report back what they see? And, when a president or one of our key officials says that our next planned mission should be to Mars. Nice, easy-sounding words, and you think you're going to be creating a precedent just like Kennedy did when he said we're going to go to the moon and bring them safely back to the Earth. And he said that in 1961, and 69 we did it. Mars is 1,000 times further in distance, probably 1,000 times more expensive. Took $31 billion in 1969 money to get to the moon. So very unlikely. You've heard me say often that we can talk about humans developing the hardware with the capability to go to Mars, but the risk and cost is both so high. I say it's not going to take place. Send unmanned missions, and they can do great things. And the 2020 launch of another lander on Mars is probably one of the things you'll be talking about tonight. Oh, you both, WS2N, K2I, that is.
Yeah, we're looking forward to that. And there was a guy, Yuri Milner, who is a billionaire from Russia. And he's got a program called the Starshot program. He's investing money. He wants to make these little tiny chips and put them into space and then push them with laser beams in the direction of Alpha Centauri. And he thinks that with laser beams he can get this up to, 1/20th or so of the speed of light. So he thinks he could get these things to go to Alpha Centauri 15, 20 years from now. They would arrive, and then because it's 4 light years away from here, so roughly 20, 28 years or something from now, we'll be able to hear back from these little transmitters about, how they made out. Stephen Hawkins was pushing for it, too. But this guy's actually put money into studying the feasibility behind something like that. I don't know if you've ever heard of that guy. Comes out of Russia. Back to you, Dick.
But for a tiny little chip to send a signal back 4 light years in distance, I guess he could do it by relaying. He's going to have a whole string of these chips along the trip and relaying the signals. That means the signal has to go through thousands and thousands of these chips to get back to the Earth. And any one of the chips break down and the signal doesn't get here. So I think there's some degree of unrealisticness. Can he really get those chips to go that fraction of the speed of light by powering them with a laser beam? Maybe. But what's that chip going to do? Does it have enough capability on board to take pictures, make measurements, and send the data back home? And to just send that data back home over that tremendous distance. I mean, right now, we have to do heroic things to talk to the Voyager 12 billion miles away from us. And that's 0.01% of the distance to Alpha Centauri, so to speak. How are you, Paul? K2RIW.
Okay. Okay, very good. You know, they have in school today, they have these courses that young kids could take, and instead of learning discrete components, you know, they learn what they have these basically they're little chips and they're magnetic and they stick together and called little bits, if you look that up on the internet, little bits. Well, I'm thinking, well, maybe these things are going to be that type of thing where, you know, they got